Talking Books on News Talk 106 to 108.
These symptoms are not any lesser than the sort of symptoms that you would get if you had a disease. So, for example, if you have a convulsion due to epilepsy or convulsion due to a dissociative or hysterical seizure, you're still having convulsions, you're still having blackouts, you're still profoundly disabled. They're absolutely real and uncontrollable to the patient. The point I usually make to my patients, because their greatest fear is that people will say they're doing it on purpose or that it's not real. If someone is frightened and their heart starts beating really, really quickly, you don't tell them it's not real and you don't tell them that they could stop it if they wanted to. It is absolutely real. It just isn't happening because it's due to a heart disease. And similarly, disabilities, pain, convulsions, etc., are just like that. They're outside of the control of the person and they are every bit as real as any other disability.
How significant is health anxiety in the modern age? And why is psychosomatic illness seen as such a socially unacceptable disorder? Hello, how are you? And you're very welcome to Talking Books. I'm Susan Cahill. It's great to have your company this evening. Well, on tonight's show, we're going to unpack these questions with two thought-provoking and robust writers. One a philosopher, the other a consultant neurologist. The winner of the 2016 Wellcome Book Prize, Dr. Suzanne O'Sullivan, discusses her fascinating first book, It's All in Your Head, True Stories of Imaginary Illness, published by Vintage Books. And Clancy Martin talks love, obsession, and all the sleaze, as revealed in his entertaining new novel, Love in Central America, published by Harville Secker. This is a show about pain, suffering, addiction, and desire. But first, can we ever fully know our lovers? And should we?
So I'm Clancy Martin. I'm a Canadian now living in the United States. I write about philosophy. I write novels. And I also write quite a bit in the popular media. I'm mostly writing fiction at the moment.
Really well done on the book, Clancy. I have to say it's an exhilarating read. A tremendous amount of sex and booze and quality hotels in this book. It is magical escapism and a very enjoyable read. I was interested to read that you began this book as a memoir and then it evolved into a fiction. Can you tell me about that?
Yes, I was with my wife up in a Buddhist monastery in the kind of the mid-level Himalayas, as we're elevation as the first Everest base camp, a monastery called Kungri Monastery in the Spiti Valley in the far northern India. And we were in a Tibetan Buddhist ceremony that was conducted entirely in Tibetan, so we couldn't understand the language, and we both had our journals. My wife, Amy Baradale, is also a writer, and I was recovering from a relationship I'd been in immediately before meeting my wife, and she suggested to me, why don't you just write the story of your last relationship? So I did, and that's basically, it was written entirely in that monastery, and then when I got back to the United States, I sent it to my agent and to a friend who'd been an editor of a previous book of mine, and they both said, wow, this is fantastic, but if you publish it as it is, no one will ever speak to you again. And so I decided to rewrite it as fiction, and I changed the male character, me, into a female character, and wound up changing an awful lot of stuff, of course, as one does. But yeah, that's the story. It was really self-preservation. I sent it to another friend, a great writer, and she told me you should absolutely publish it exactly the way that it is. You shouldn't change a word. But she, although a very famous writer, I can't mention her name, she also has suffered terribly in her career from being too honest, and now kind of lives a very secluded life as a consequence of her honesty. So I thought, well, even though I trust her advice at some level, she's also a cautionary tale.
Cheating on your husband is a lot like doing cocaine. It's rarely pleasurable, but try quitting. It's a tremendous line, Clancy. I loved it. But it got me thinking, is love a drug?
Well, I think that falling in love certainly is an awful lot like a drug. And, you know, I suppose insofar as we take these things seriously, they've done a lot of neuro studies that show that the kinds of chemicals that are activated in your brain when you're falling in love are similar to a variety of different drugs that people like to take. I mean, they're just blasting away in your brain when you're falling in love. And I think that when we think of the, you know, really intense, brief, erotic love, it is very similar to taking a drug with all of the problems that come with taking drugs, drug addiction, that kind of thing. Now, it may also be the case that sustained erotic love in marriage has drug-like components. I know for me, I think a major reason that I was able to get off antidepressants and anti-anxiety drugs, which I started taking as a consequence of my alcoholism, was really the love I have for my wife and children. So I think that the answer is yes, love is emphatically like a drug. And the question is, what kind of love and what kind of drug? You know, there are good drugs and bad drugs, and there's good love and bad love.
Well, sex is quite a drug in a way in this novel, and it plays a pretty big part. And Brett, Paul and Edward, your three main protagonists, all of them have a very dirty, sleazy side to them. I'm just wondering, what was that like, pitching up these three very disparate and very crazy characters?
It's an interesting. I definitely am trying to show them at their most exposed during this incredibly difficult time. And I think that all of us, ordinary human beings, have times in our lives when you will sort of catch us at our worst, I suppose. And they might be some of the most stressful times in our lives. And they might be, you know, times when you're falling in love, cheating, suffering from addiction of some kind. You know, Brett, part of her problem is that she's an alcoholic, and she thinks that she's recovered, and then she falls in love, and she realizes that she has not recovered. So I think the situation is bringing out the worst in Brett, Edward, and Paul. Now, Edward, I have quite a bit of sympathy in my heart for Brett and Paul both. Edward, not so much. But I'm sure that Edward, at the end of the day, has his good qualities, too. It's just I was less concerned about understanding the sympathetic side of Edward's nature than I was in the sympathetic side of Brett and Paul's. And Brett and Paul, I hope it comes through in the novel, have been happier, have been better people, but just find themselves, Brett, because of making some bad decisions that she is unable to correct, and then Paul, because of being married to somebody who's making some really bad decisions, are sort of incapable of sort of showing their better sides. But Edward, I don't know if we ever really get to see Edward's better side.
And Brett and Paul are married, and Edward is Brett's lover on the side. They take a lot of drugs, very, very heavy duty sex, some very rough play. And I'm just wondering, some of your readers may find that a lot to take and would find it a little off tune. What do you say to that?
Well, yes, I think some readers have found it to be a little bit intense. And I suppose all I can say is that I'm showing a particular, as a writer, as an artist, I'm trying to show a particular kind of erotic experience, a particularly intense, I think, kind of erotic experience that hopefully has aspects of what it is like to fall in love for anybody who falls in love, particularly maybe the experience of first love, which is one that I find fascinating. This was not first love for Brett when she falls in love with Edward. She has fallen in love before, but, you know, in some ways, falling in love always has those elements of the first lover who is discovering this new territory for the first time. Anybody who's fallen in love more than once has had the feeling that, oh, I've forgotten that life could be like this. I had forgotten that love could be like this, you know, that kind of intensity of being alive, as opposed to most of us might live our ordinary lives kind of feeling like we're skating on the surface of reality, but suddenly they are deep down in it, like Dionysian reality in Nietzsche's sense of Dionysus, really living, breathing experience. For my purposes, putting them in those extreme circumstances does help to illustrate that kind of intensity of experience. But also, for those readers who feel like, no, this is just too much, I mean, there are other less intense accounts of love, and we're all familiar with them, and maybe those are better suited to those readers.
Well, frankly, I really enjoyed the book, you know, and if you want a less intense read, well, maybe I go out to the garden with some other stuff. But I was just wondering, you raise a lot of very provocative questions about the nature of love, the nature of intimacy, the nature of relationships and how we understand our lovers. Is it ever possible, really, Clancy, to actually fully understand another person, and especially somebody that you're very sexually drawn to? Is that part of the whole deal, that you just have to live and spaciously live with the mysteries that surround people? And maybe if you do get to know them on that true intimate level, that's when it all dissolves?
Yeah, intimately related and equally fascinating questions. A Buddhist thinker I very much admire, a fellow named Trungpa Rinpoche, observes that we are all fundamentally lonely, and then he goes on to say, the deeper the loneliness, the deeper the love. And I think there's something very important to that observation that we can all sympathize with, whether it is love for our parents, love for our partners, or love for our children. The more you love them, the more you recognize, okay, this person is fundamentally different, unknowable to me, and I have to be okay with that in order to love them properly, you know. So I think the short answer is no, we cannot ever know anybody else, and we don't feel that acutely until we are loving them. And the more we love them, the more acutely we feel it. And that's a good thing. It's a good thing to be aware of our loneliness in that way. That's a little bit of a step in the right direction of being as human as possible, because other people are suffering from the same loneliness we are, you know, and you have to acknowledge that and recognize that we all have to take care of each other, even though we are in these lonely worlds of ours. Now, your more, in a way, more provocative question, does the sexual tension disappear when we no longer have that mysterious element of the unknowable, or if you know, familiarity sort of breeding contempt, I suppose? I don't know. I think that certainly that discovering of a new territory of another human being is extremely exciting and an erotic experience, you know, where everybody has to admit it's just great. It's like I often tell my students, you know, you make a long list of your experiences, ranking them from best to worst, and if it makes sense to make such a list at all, and you will see that the first time you kiss somebody is always up at the top of those experiences. I mean, there's just nothing like it, the first time you kiss somebody. It's a very unique human experience. But also, I think that the richer kinds of experiences that we have of love, even erotic love, wind up involving this kind of increasing investigation into the unknowability of some other human being. So, in other words, if you're feeling familiarity with someone else you love, I think that's just because you're not paying attention. You're just getting bored of yourself. You're really not doing a good job of investigating that other person. Because if you really try to investigate another person because you love them, you will find them inexhaustible. They are even more confusing than you are, because at least in your own case, you've been stuck with yourself for 30, 40, 50 years, but then you're only beginning to know.
It's an interesting area. It's very hard. There's so many unknowns in falling in love, though. Can I ask you about addiction? Because one of the key themes in the book is Brett's secret drinking and then her downward spiral, where she becomes completely chaotic. Within any relationship, there's highs and lows. And, you know, addiction can come into a relationship in all sorts of ways. Do you think it's possible to navigate a loving relationship with such a heavy-duty addiction? Or do you think they'd eventually become a barrier? Because in this story, it's one chaotic downward spiral. And I'm just wondering, can we apply that broadly? Or was that something that you were trying or attempting to deconstruct in some way?
Yeah, I do think that being in a relationship with someone who is suffering from an addiction is much more difficult, at least in some ways, than being in a relationship with someone who is not. So that's the first thing I would say, is that it's tough to be in a relationship with someone who has an addiction. And I can say that really only from watching people who have been in relationships with me. I have been in relationships with people who have had problems, substance abuse problems, basically always alcohol. But, I've always been sort of worse off than they were, so I've been the more challenging one. And I know it's really hard for them. Now, I do think, however, that I have to believe, because of my own experience, that, putting the effort into an addict is worth it. And sometimes it's inevitable. I mean, if it's your child, for example, and possibly also your parent, hopefully you're not going to just write that person off because of their addiction. But with partners, we do have this option of just writing the person off, no longer engaging with them. I think that, for me, the story of Brett and her addiction is about her starting to recognize how much damage she's doing to other people, how much damage she's doing to herself, how low she can sink as long as she continues to let herself be a victim of her own addiction. Now, the people around her who are trying to help her, they are victimized by her. And why did they stick around? I suppose all she can do is hope that they think that it'll be worth it at the end of the day, sticking around. And if they don't, she has to take responsibility for the fact that they haven't. So I guess the answer to your question is, I do think that staying in a relationship with an addicted person, I have to believe, is going to be worth it, but it's not going to be easy. And, I don't know if there's more for me to say to it than that. I did want to, in the book, illustrate both how difficult it is to be in love with Brett and show that Brett doesn't have anybody at the end of the day to blame other than herself, which can be very hard for an addict to realize. And again, that's something I wrestled with very intensely myself, with my own struggle with alcoholism.
As I said earlier, there's no heroes or heroines in this novel, but they are incredibly interesting characters. Within all of that, there isn't a huge amount of forgiveness or grace or humility in how your three characters certainly understand the world and the mistakes they have made in their marriages. I'm just wondering, what were you trying to say within the storyline on marriage? I know that Brett's best friend, Sadie, makes a comment about her own marriage breakup. And she says, "When I left my first husband for another man, it was only because my husband was sad and the new man was happy. Every time I walked into the room, he lit up. The reason your marriage ends can be that simple." Do you actually believe that?
I do believe that. I do believe that it can be that simple and that quick, and that sort of apparently meaningless, although there's probably a much richer subtext there. As anyone who's dealt with someone who's sort of chronically sad or chronically depressed might attest. But what I was trying to do, vis-a-vis the question of marriage and relationships and in the book, was absolutely to show, and I'm really glad you picked that particular text because it does show it, to show the fragility of those relationships, how incredibly careful we have to be and watchful, vigilant, if we want to succeed in long-term erotic relationships. One of the reasons I love marriage as a case study in love and long-term erotic relationships generally is that, unlike many other loving relationships, they have this heightened fragility. You know, when it comes to the love of our children, although we're also very, very mindful, very watchful, very vigilant of how they feel about us, you do feel like there's a kind of endurance. With the love you have for your parents, you take it for granted a little bit, but similarly, you have this confidence that comes from some mysterious link. And similarly with our friends, you kind of feel like if one of your friends doesn't love you anymore, then you're better off without that friend. But you don't feel that way about a lover. So I wanted to illustrate the fragility in a variety of different ways. The fragility in terms of attack, you know, when Brett and Edward first sleep together, the thing she says to Edward is, I'm in love with my husband. And he says, I know. Nevertheless, she does what she does, which someone who has been in a similar circumstance will confirm the truth. And people do this even though she loves Paul the whole time. Nevertheless, she makes these kinds of decisions, which is just the way, unfortunately, that it works. And I think St. Augustine got this right when he said the greatest part of virtue lies in avoiding the opportunities for vice. I think that's exactly right, but it can be very difficult to learn that lesson.
And what about complacency within all of that? Do you think that we're possibly in times, whether it's in our relationships, friendships, marriages, whatever it is, that we get into that kind of complacent state that we actually don't think about the consequences of it? That just coasting and that sense of, yeah, yeah, yeah. And really, that there are consequences to that and big ones too.
I think that's exactly right. The flip side of this is complacency, not recognizing one's obligation to be careful, not just for one's own sake, but for the sake of the people that you love. And yes, absolutely. I think that complacency, taking for granted, is what creates these opportunities. And that's the way in which also we might hold Paul a little bit accountable in his relationship with Brett, is that there is this deep complacency in the character of Paul, which I think, again, all of us can understand. You know, you start getting overwhelmed with children, with your day-to-day responsibilities, with just ordinary life, and you start to take the person you love for granted. You start to be complacent. And then whether that leads you into making a bad decision because you are happy to have a little excitement added to your life, or that leads them into making a bad decision because they feel like they don't matter to you in the same way. Either way, it provides this window of opportunity for destruction.
Lastly, Clancy, as a philosopher as well as a novelist and writer, when the book was finally published and you picked it up into your hand and you leafed through the pages and you were, you know, as we started off talking about, you know, that you began the novel as a memoir and you were reading through some of the cheap, shoddy stuff that tricks that Brett, your female protagonist, gets up to in her marriage and how she cheats and lies so exquisitely to her husband, Paul, and how she finds herself in this very compromising, sexually aggressive, volatile, if not terribly dysfunctional relationship with Edward. While it is exciting, nonetheless, it is very, very messy. I'm just wondering, as you read through those pages, and obviously there's nuances to your own life and some truths in there, lured between the fiction and the creativity, did you learn anything?
I did. I absolutely learned that what I wanted from my own love relationships and what I wanted for my own love relationships was something different than excitement, something different than novelty. And to be perfectly frank, I finally had kind of hammered home in my mind that you can't wait until the opportunity is in front of you to be careful. You have to be careful about 10 steps before that. But I had to see it all spelled out. I really had to see it in front of my own face, the kind of destruction that can be wreaked on the people one loves by a person who is living in this day-to-day way, not looking up from his or her feet to look around, but just kind of looking from one step to the next. I had to understand how much damage can be done. And by writing it all out, I could see it there. I could see, okay, this is no way for a person to live who wants to keep on living, and no way for a person to treat other human beings who wants to be loved.
Thank you.
chat with writer and philosopher Professor Clancy Martin. Love in Central America is published by Harville Secker and retails for in around €9 in paperback or just under €2 on a Kindle. Not bad value at all. Now, I can also recommend some of other of Clancy's big reads, including Love and Lies, How to Sell, Morality and the Good Life, The Philosophy of Deception, and Ethics Across Professions. All again by Clancy Martin.
Talking Books on Newstalk 106 to 108.
And you're very welcome back to Talking Books. I'm Susan Cahill. It's lovely to have your company this evening. The Wellcome Book Prize is an annual award open to new works of fiction or non-fiction whose central theme engages with some aspect of medicine, health or illness. Well, this year's shortlist included some stunning reads: Playthings by Alec Fenby, It's All in Your Head by Suzanne O'Sullivan, The Last Act of Love by Kathy Resenbrink, Neurotribes by Steve Silverban, Signs for Lost Children by Sarah Moss, and The Outrun by Amy Liptrop. Well, this evening we're going to meet with the talented Dr. Suzanne O'Sullivan, whose first book, It's All in Your Head, True Stories of Imaginary Illness, won this year's Wellcome Book Prize.
So my name is Suzanne O'Sullivan. I'm a consultant in neurology and clinical neurophysiology, which means that I care for people who have diseases of the nervous system. So it could be diseases of the brain or the spinal cord or of the muscles. And I'm particularly interested in caring for people who have epilepsy and different sorts of convulsions. Over the course of a 10-year consultancy career, I have also started caring for people who have disorders that I'm referring to here as psychosomatic disorders. So people with very serious disabilities, things like paralysis, convulsions, blindness, where the cause is actually psychological rather than being due to an actual disease. That interest led me to write a book called It's All in Your Head, which was published last year, for which I was very proud to receive the Wellcome Book Prize earlier this year.
Really well done on the book, Suzanne. It's a surprising read. It's truly enthralling. It got me thinking, do we all somatize our emotions to some degree, or at least suffer from a sense of health anxiety?
I think that it is a very important point to make, is that we all have physical symptoms for emotional or psychological reasons at some point. And that obviously doesn't mean that we all suffer with a psychosomatic disorder, but everybody's had a situation where they've had palpitations because they've been scared, or headache because they've had a stressful day. These are really common ways that people convert psychological distress into a physical symptom. But obviously that doesn't lead to disability for most of us. For most of us, that just disappears spontaneously and we're able to get on with our lives. But unfortunately, for a small number of people, it doesn't disappear and it can become a really big problem.
You write in your introductions that modern society likes the idea that we can cure ourselves, or that we can will ourselves better in some way. So do you think in some ways we're rather judgmental in our approach to people who have psychosomatic illness?
I think we have a very interesting contradictory response to the way we look at the interaction between our psychological well-being and our physical well-being. So people are very willing and open-minded to explore different psychological techniques to help them get through diseases and get through illnesses. But people are less open-minded to the idea that you can think yourself unwell. And I think really that's a very stigmatized disorder, and people really consider it to a certain degree to be a weakness. If you're disabled or you have a significant physical disability which has psychological cause, people have difficulty separating the person from the disorder, and I think that really creates a huge problem in medicine.
Have we totally underestimated the power of the mind over the body, do you think, Suzanne?
Well, I think most people have. I think that people are usually very surprised when they discover that, say, one in five people who go to an epilepsy clinic with convulsions have a disorder that we refer to as dissociative seizures, which are convulsions for purely psychological reasons. So it's an extremely common problem of which neurologists have been aware for many, many years, but general public seem to be less aware. So I think that people are not familiar with the power of the mind over the body.
How big an issue is personality in all of this, and what
right.
and the experiences that we've lived through in our lives, and how does that shape our view of yeah. our illness at any time?
I think it's really important to say that while personality can play a part in this, we would be very judgmental and foolish to think that you have to be a certain sort of person to get these disorders. And I think that's one of the situations that creates stigma. People believe you have to be a certain sort of person in order to develop a disability of this severity. The truth is, it could happen to anybody. You just need to encounter the correct set of circumstances or the trauma or stressor that is big enough, and it could happen to you. I mean, it is true to say that there are certain personality types, people prone to anxiety, people who are worriers are more likely to develop psychosomatic illness than other people. But it's by no means the case that they are the only people who develop this. This is something that can happen pretty much to anybody.
You write something very curious in your introductions. You write that psychosomatic illnesses, that they are disorders of the imagination restricted only by the limits of the imagination. I thought that was really interesting, but I'm not sure do I fully understand it.
Yeah.
So can you talk me through it?
Yeah, I mean, basically, when we develop a disability for psychological reasons, it doesn't come from nowhere. So it's rarely going to be something completely random. It's usually something that we have encountered in some way before, or it's a response to some injury. So, for example, if I have a sibling who suffers with epilepsy and I've seen lots of seizures, then perhaps when I manifest a psychosomatic disorder, I might manifest it as a seizure because that's a familiar representation of stress, of distress, that I've seen at some point in my life. So it's whatever exists in your imagination will be how your symptom comes out. Or similarly, if you injure your leg, then you imagine that the injury is not going to get better and you start worrying about the injury and paying attention to the injury, that will mold the shape of the disability that you develop. So you're unlikely to develop a disability or a symptom that you've never encountered before that has no meaning to you. It will usually have some relevance to something that lives inside your own past experience and your imagination.
One of the surprising aspects of the book is that through your research that you notice that women are more vulnerable to psychosomatic illness or unexplained illness. I think somewhere that you said that 70% of patients who present to a doctor or have an unexplained illness are women. How do you explain that? Because it's startling, it's frightening. And women like to see themselves as very robust, that we're resilient, that we're sturdy, that we go through all these life changes and that we're great copers. So it's sort of almost counterintuitive, really.
Yeah, I mean, I absolutely resisted. When I was training in medicine, I was certainly made aware that women were more likely to suffer from these sort of disorders, but I'm not sure that I ever entirely believed it. You know, I believe that, you know, we lived in a system, certainly then and still now, where the majority of consultants were male and that they were making these judgments about women. And similarly, in the historical study of these disorders, women were generally talked about, written about much more than men. So I resisted the idea that it was a female-predominant disorder in the first instance because I am a woman and because I agree with what you're saying. However, I had to admit over the course of my own practice that far more of my patients are women than men also. I think that I can't account for the exact reason for why that is, but I think that there's certainly some influencing factors. First of all, the kind of situations that lead people to develop psychosomatic disorders are situations in which women are more likely to find themselves than men. So situations in which you're trapped, situations from which you can't escape. Anyone who suffered significant physical or sexual abuse in the past is more likely to be affected, and these are things that women are vulnerable to. Similarly, I think there's a sort of a cultural determination in that the way that women are allowed to express their distress is different than the way that men express their distress. We know, obviously, that men are more likely to become alcoholics. It's very sad to say that there's a very high level of suicide in young men. So I think men and women are both suffering, and they're both suffering equally but differently.
It struck me as I was going through some of your case studies, and they make for fascinating, if not somewhat alarming, reading, that in some cases doctors need to learn a greater sense of compassion. Do you think that's fair to say, or do you think that's me being hard on the medical profession?
No, I don't think it's unfair. I think that doctors struggle with these disorders, understanding them and accepting them every bit as much as lay people do. So I think that it is very difficult. So, for example, I describe in the book a woman who's blind, and there's no disease that will explain her blindness. What's more, some of her behavior is really contradictory to her own experience of being blind. So, for example, although she cannot see anything at all on formal testing, in her distracted moments, she's able to reach out and pick things up, which she should not be able to do if she were indeed permanently blind. Now, when doctors encounter these sort of things, just in the same way as when lay people encounter these things, it's very difficult to understand how this woman could truly experience being profoundly blind when her behavior suggests otherwise. And that leads us into situations where we doubt the honesty of people and we worry about intent. And I think it was certainly a journey for me as a doctor, and that's part of what I've written about in the book also, is trying to, through working with people, understand that these disabilities are absolutely real, they're absolutely profound and life-destroying. And I think not every doctor has had the opportunity of the journey that I've had, and therefore they struggle with understanding these disorders. But I think we really need to change that, because when you're in medical school, you are never taught about psychosomatic conditions. You're taught to diagnose disease. You're never taught what you should do when disease has been ruled out, but the person is still struggling, they're still in pain, or they're still disabled. I think medical school really needs to begin to work on that.
And whatever presenting symptoms that there are, they're very real for the patient who's suffering them or experiencing them, aren't they?
Well, that is the most important point to make. I mean, that these symptoms are not any lesser than the sort of symptoms that you would get if you had a disease. So, for example, if you have a convulsion due to epilepsy or a convulsion due to a dissociative or hysterical seizure, you're still having convulsions, you're still having blackouts, you're still profoundly disabled. They're absolutely real and uncontrollable to the patient. The point I usually make to my patients, because their greatest fear is that people will say they're doing it on purpose or that it's not real. If someone is frightened and their heart starts beating really, really quickly, you don't tell them it's not real, and you don't tell them that they could stop it if they wanted to. It is absolutely real. It just isn't happening because it's due to a heart disease. And similarly, disabilities, pain, convulsions, etc., are just like that. They're outside of the control of the person, and they are every bit as real as any other disability.
Can we talk about Pauline? I think she was your first case study.
Mm-hmm.
She was experiencing pretty traumatic convulsions. She'd very bad physical pain. She was fairly immobile by the time she presented into your office.
Yeah.
You write, there are always two realities, the one which exists in the notes and the one which lives in the patient's memory. I thought that was fascinating, and it got me thinking, how do you navigate it all? Because, you know, there's different truths at play, and you need to figure out what the ultimate truth of the medical condition is, and that can be a repressed memory or trauma.
Yeah.
So how do you dig around? Because you're dealing with, in some cases, parents who are very protective of their children. In other cases, you were dealing with partners who took great offence when you were challenging whether it was neurological-based illness or was it a psychosomatic illness. So how do you get at the heart of the truth?
Really, it takes an awful lot of time. So what used to happen in the past is if we, doctors that is, saw people who had psychosomatic disorders, you know, we would challenge people and say something must have happened, something must be upsetting you. And this caused great friction between patient and doctor and was also entirely inappropriate because while traumatic things can certainly cause psychosomatic disorders, that's not the only way they develop. And therefore, if doctors kind of are over-probing or over-accusatory at the beginning, you will create a situation where you're insisting that your patient has been traumatized in some way and they're insisting that they haven't been, and you'll never, ever progress beyond that point. So I don't make any assumptions at all at any point. Really just go through the story, and it will often be with repeated meetings and with repeated consultations and with other people, specialist nurses, psychologists, psychiatrists, social workers, physiotherapists. As the whole team gets involved, it's often a very slowly evolving story. And it can be the case that we never really understand why somebody has become disabled, but that doesn't mean that they can't be helped. They can find new ways of reacting to symptoms without ever having to fully understand how they started in the first instance.
And of course, Suzanne, doctors are human beings, and like all human beings,
exactly.
we suffer from frustration, anger, we can be tired, we can be anxious ourselves, stressed out, and we can make the wrong decisions on a tough day. So
yeah,
you're juggling a lot of things. You mentioned Mark, he was another of your case studies. He had convinced himself that he had multiple cirrhosis. Mm-hmm. And you say something which I thought was very, very relevant. She said he was a product of the internet age.
Yeah.
Because ultimately we're all putting in through search engines, you know, different physical symptoms and looking for answers.
Yes. I think, you know, I'm very often asked whether or not I think that the internet has increased the number of people who suffer with psychosomatic disorders. And I have to say, I absolutely don't think it's increased the numbers at all. I think that this way of expressing our distress and dysfunctional way of responding to injuries, etc., has always been present. All that the internet has done really is change the language that people use for their symptoms and the attributions that people give to their symptoms. So once upon a time, if you had chronic back pain and you were worried about it and it was developing into a problem with your legs, for example, you'd discuss it with people in your life and you'd come to conclusions based on those discussions. Now we go to the internet and we come to conclusions based on internet searches. So I don't think it's enormously changed the frequency of these disorders, but it's certainly changed the way people refer to these disorders and the ideas that they get as to what could be causing the disorder. Frequency and severity, I'd say, has unchanged for many years.
Do you think in some way that whether it's with our friends or with our family or with our partners, that we can be very tough on psychosomatic illness? Not just that we may be very judgmental, but that we may not give it the weight it's due, that we think that it's socially unacceptable.
I absolutely think that that's how people are. I often would think about the different ways we treat people according to what the cause of their disability was. So if you imagine that there's somebody who's a colleague of yours at work and you overlap in some of your work and they go off sick and you discover that they're having convulsions or that they're in a wheelchair and you believe that the reason that they are unwell is because they have a serious disease like multiple sclerosis, for example, well, then you absorb their extra work and you feel sympathy for them and you contact them and let them know that you feel sympathy for them. Now, let's say that you suddenly discovered that actually this person doesn't have multiple sclerosis, that actually the reason they're in their wheelchair or the reason they're having convulsions is actually psychological rather than being due to a brain disease. I think that immediately changes the way we see that person. And I think it also changes the way that we treat that person, the way we communicate with them. And I think a lot of people will have a shift in their sympathies and will also believe that that person could snap out of it, so to speak, if they just tried hard enough. You know, but the truth is that these kind of disorders are actually harder to treat than many physical diseases. And because we don't have quite the same respect for them, we also don't do the research or plow the resources into them that we do into other conditions. So in many ways, they are more difficult than equivalent disabilities caused for different reasons.
Can we talk about Camilla? I found her story or her case notes particularly touching. She was a very capable woman. She was working very, very hard, very demanding job. And she suddenly started having fairly traumatic seizures, which became quite crippling.
Yes, I mean, you know, Camilla was an extremely successful person by anybody's standards. And when she she began having seizures, and they transpired to be dissociative seizures. In the first instance, it really seemed to be an entire mystery. And she very much was the sort of person that people referred to her as being not the sort of person who would get dissociative seizures, calling the diagnosis into question. The point being that anybody can get these sort of problems if they meet a trauma that is sufficient enough. It transpired, although it took a long time for it to come to light, that Camilla had lost a child in a very traumatic circumstance. The child was knocked down by a car in a situation in which Camilla felt very culpable. Now, she was aware that she had this trauma in her life, and she was aware that it was something which was very emotionally charged for her. But somehow she failed to connect in her mind this severe psychological trauma with what was happening to her physically. And it's likely that in her situation that the seizures were almost protecting her from the feelings that she had in relation to her child, that the seizures were serving a purpose. When things got too much for Camilla, her body was shutting down to protect her from it. So there was a sense in which the seizures were, first of all, a warning to her. They were telling her that there was something that was wrong that she wasn't fully aware of. She felt that she had dealt with the loss of her child. The seizures were suggesting otherwise. But they were also protecting her from the extreme pain involved with that sort of loss. So they were, in a sense, her friend. They were, in a sense, serving a purpose for her, and therefore very difficult for her to relinquish. But once she kind of saw the connection between the loss of her child and the seizures, it gave her great relief and did result in the seizures slowly melting away over time.
Yeah, you say that she was a very competent and successful lady. She clearly was highly intelligent.
Yeah.
But it doesn't matter how intelligent you may be, you know, accepting a diagnosis of a psychosomatic illness is not easiest for the most capable person in the world.
I mean, it can be really difficult for people to accept that our minds can produce something as dramatic as blindness or paralysis or seizures. So people really struggle to accept that that is even possible. What I usually will say to people is that, you know, in fact, these sort of things are really common in small ways. They affect all of us. You know, we constantly have an experience where we're looking right at something that we're looking for and we don't see it. So we're filtering out visual experiences as part of our daily life, whereas these extreme disabilities are just an extreme version of that. It's very important that we realize that that is the case, because it helps people to understand that this isn't exclusively a disorder of someone who is defective or weak in some way. This is a disorder that can literally happen to anybody should the right circumstances arise. And I generally find that when people are able to think about the diagnosis, consider the diagnosis, it gives people a huge amount of relief. Just to be able to start making the connections will often alleviate the symptoms or even just make people feel better about the symptoms in general and change the way they react to them in the future.
Last question, Suzanne, and it's something that you developed throughout the book, that all medicine is an art.
Yes, I think, you know, that there really is no comparison between practicing medicine and being taught medicine in a lecture theatre or in a tutorial or through reading it in a book. You know, you can sit down and read all the symptoms of multiple sclerosis and epilepsy, but then when you encounter a person with those diseases, they're not going to give you the textbook description of what they're experiencing. They're going to come to you with a story that's laden with their own experience, with their language, their own personal language for it. They will have come to conclusions based on their education, based on their reading. So each person will present you their disease in their own way, through their own personal experience. And it doesn't in any way compare with trying to make a diagnosis by reading a book or looking at a list of symptoms. I remember a friend once said to me, why didn't we just create, you know, a computer paradigm that you just put in all the symptoms and the computer prints out a diagnosis? But it would be utterly impossible, because once you start meeting patients, you know, the terminology they use, the concern they come into the room with that you're unaware of will color everything they say to you. They'll come in with some concern that is unique to them because of their position, and that will influence their story. So no computer will ever be able to do the work of a doctor, I don't think. It's entirely a relationship between two people, and it's the interpreting of a story and allowing a story to unfold slowly in its own time.
his consultant neurologist, Dr. Suzanne O'Sullivan. It's All in Your Head, True Stories of Imaginary Illness. It's published by Vintage Books and retails for in around €22 in hardback or just over €10 on an ebook. Well, that's it for Talking Books for another week. I hope you enjoyed the show. All that's left for me to do now is to say a very big thank you to Ronan Brannock, who helped out with this week's programme, and the lovely Lee Duncan on sound. We've been talking books. I'd like to end tonight's broadcast with the compassionate and enlightened words of Dr. Suzanne O'Sullivan from It's All in Your Head, True Stories of Imaginary Illness. For us to consider a psychological cause for serious illness, it is vital that we believe that such a thing is possible, and how extreme psychosomatic illness can sometimes be. For people to accept the reality of psychosomatic illness, they must accept the power of the mind over the body. We seem to be happy to accept reports of people using hypnosis in places of anesthesia, the placebo effect, the use of sports psychologists, homeopathy and alternative medicines, the effect of meditation and cancer diets, and any number of other examples of how the mind can influence the body. Why is the idea of the mind reproducing physical symptoms any harder to credit? For all the positive effects the mind can have, there just as easily can be negative ones. There is no point resisting. Disability for psychological reasons is all around us. It can exist and does. It is a common problem that could affect anybody, ourselves, as well as the people we know and love. If public perception is to change, each of us would have to accept that part of ourselves which reacts physically to the world around us. Maybe if we understood better the way our own bodies lose control, triggered only by a feeling inside, then more extreme reactions might not seem so unacceptable, because we do all somatize our emotions, whether or not we acknowledge it. Good night.